Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
You've got all kinds of things that you can make part of the dressing that can add something to the dimension. And I don't see any reason to use lead shot apart from even if you were using maybe streamers, maybe. But even then, we've got some fairly subtle, you know, lead impregnated leaders, poly leaders with tungsten in them.
That was Charles Jardine with his take on lead split shot, the lefty cray of the UK today on the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. If you get a chance, head over to wetflyswing.com/live to check out our next live podcast we have going on. We're testing out some new things this year, and the link at live is the best place to catch up on that. Charles Jardine, one of the great contemporary fly fishermen from the UK, shed some light on nymph fishing. We hear about UK nymphing and why it's not much different than fishing in the US. And we find out which are Charles's favorite nymphing books. He's got one that is pretty much your must-go-to, must-have book. Before we get started, let's hear from our sponsors. TurtleBox is a new company I've been working with this year. They build an amazing portable speaker that is louder and more rugged than anything I've ever encountered. Unlike most other portable speakers out there, the TurtleBox was specifically built with the sportsman in mind. I've talked with the guys at TurtleBox, saw dudes by the way. They love the outdoors and are all avid sportsmen. This is a product I can truly say does not disappoint. Go ahead and check the guys out at turtleboxaudio.com.
OPST's rods represent decades of dedication to sustained anchor two-handed casting. These rods are a true illustration of Skagit Master Ed Ward's vision. The Micro Series comes exceptionally close to single-handed specs and is proving to be a unique tool for trout and smallmouth anglers alike. Head over to wetflyswing.com/OPST to get started right now. That's wetflyswing.com/OPST. So without further ado, here is Charles Jardine from charlesjardine.co.uk.
How's it going, Charles?
I'm doing very, very well. It seems very weird, doesn't it? You in one country, me in another.
Yeah. No, you know what I mean? It seems amazing to me because the more I do this, and we have obviously a lot more US-based episodes, but I'm thinking about, you know, like, why do we not have more UK episodes, more Europe? You know what I mean? It's just, and the struggle is that we got one show. I think I would need like three or four shows to cover the world, right?
Yeah, well, it just seems, Dave, that the Euro nymphing, has just swept all before it in your country at the moment. I mean, it's just bizarre. And, you know, the irony in all of it is the most curious thing to me is the fact that you pretty much invented it. Now, I know that sounds ridiculous, but
yeah,
I'm going straight in here, aren't I?
Really? It is perfect.
I mean, I remember fishing in Colorado back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, and it was just outside of Vail. We were doing a thing with a hotel group out there, and we're a group of journalists coming out from the UK. And I saw these guys using Stren, yellow Stren, and high sticking the various rivers in Colorado, and thought, oh, they're onto something here. And you've been tightline nymphing for generations. Yeah. I mean, for goodness sake, you know, so it's nothing like reinventing a wheel, is there really?
Yep. Well, I'm glad you jumped right into the Euro Nifty game because you're right. It has swept. It's like Euro. And if you look at my most popular episodes, you know, what we've had on here, they're most of the top 10 are Euro are related. Right. And we've interviewed everybody from, you know, Bill Fish all the way down to everything. And it's all and Euro is the thing. But I'm curious on the history because we had, you know, Gary Borger was on here. He talked about some of the past history.
Oh, dear Gary, what a wonderful man. Yeah. He must have had fun with Gary. He's just a delight, isn't he?
It was amazing. Yeah, he told his story and stuff. But it was interesting because the nymph fishing, I want to check with you to see on the UK side of it because I'm a little confused on the history there. Can you just take us back and talk a little bit how...
Yeah, I can a little bit. I mean, history is always something that, you know, probably happened and is gets lost in interpretation, frankly.
So
nymph fishing was pretty much codified by George Edward Mackenzie Skews. Now, there's a name to conjure with. Yep. Now, everyone looks at Skews as the sort of creator, the godfather of nymphs. But what they overlook is the fact that he got all his ideas from the North Country, what we call spider fishers, wet fly fishers, who were not fishing. And I'm saying this because you've got that lovely title, wet fly swing.
Yep.
Everyone thinks that when you put on a soft tackle, you fish it across and down. These guys weren't. They were actually fishing it upstream to their quarry. And we're going to 1840, 1860s, nice. Probably even before then. And then Skews had this idea, well, and he was in conversation with these guys, and he was around about 1910, around about that period. And he decided to look at nature in the river, on the chalk streams that he fished, on the River Itchen especially, which is just outside of Winchester. And noticed the nymphs and the way they hatched and so forth. So he put basically a thorax on wet flies and fished them just subsurface. Now, there is no way in this world, or indeed any other, that those flies could have sunk much deeper than maybe a few inches. They just weren't, they weren't constructed that way. And if anyone is a student of the sport, if they look at Skew's nymphs, they'll see that basically you've got a pattern over there called a flimph or emergers. And they're not that far apart from it. They're really not. But what the critical difference was, they went underneath the surface, whereas Halford and all his acolytes said, no, it's got to be dry fly fished on the surface. And so this great big furore kicked off, and one wouldn't talk to the other. And, you know, there were battles fought across the water meadows. It was horrible.
Yeah.
But, so essentially they were just fishing emergers. And then along came a few others. But I suppose the real game changer for me, looking at it historically, and I'm sure there were people before this, was Sawyer, Frank Sawyer. Mm. Now, he was a river keeper on the Upper Avon, just outside of Salisbury, going upstream. He was an incredible man. I got my first ever proper lesson from Frank. And he was an elegant man of the ground, of the earth. I mean, he was a river keeper. He was a countryman through and through, and understood about the rhythm of a river. And he basically judged all and based all his patterns on what he observed. And that's how you got the pheasant tail nymph. That's how you got all his patterns.
Right.
Very simple. And he worked out that if you put a certain amount of copper wire in these patterns, that they would get down to a certain depth and you could fish at a, you know, quite a considerable depth. However, what people forget is before all that, there are a number of French patterns that actually were constructed very, very similarly. So as soon as you have one person, you've generally got somebody else that thought of it before you, and you know so it goes on, and it's this cyclical thing. But I think Skews is generally seen as the father of nymph fishing, but I think Sawyer popularized fishing at substantial depths in beneath the surface.
That's it.
And I think that's the best way to look at it, really.
Perfect. Yeah. And I And we've talked on wet fly, and I love, you know, obviously the wet fly swing, you know, does think of, you know, focused on, you know, swinging flies, but we had Davey Watton on as well, who I'm sure you're aware of. Davey. Yeah.
Oh, Davey and I go back. I mean, we were in the same county in Kent.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I used to encounter Davey at various fisheries. What a heck of a fly tyer that man is. And he's done so well for himself out in America. Yeah. It's just a joy. I mean, I see him occasionally, but it's never long enough, and it's never enough.
That's right.
Actually,
well, what's so with Davey Watt? I love, because we've talked about his story about how it came to be, and he got out here. So, I mean, he made the transfer. So why? And I know you've done a ton of fishing out in the U.S. What's kept you going back to UK? Why not come out and hang out with us for good?
But for the life of me, I've been asking myself the same question for the last 30 years. You know, I first came out to America, and I fell in love with it back in about 1976, which is a heck of a long time ago, really, when you think about it. And the world's changed hugely. And I think it's that fearful thing of always thinking that it was going to be more difficult than perhaps it probably would have been.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've been happy going. If you look at it in this way, I've got the perfect life, because I can come over and fish in, I don't know, Northern California or Eastern California or Montana or you know, wherever. I've got friends who've got some lovely water in Colorado who I go and visit. You know, and I can celebrate the very best and still come back and fish the very best in Britain. So, you know, I really am, you know, I have had my cake and eating it too, the whole lot, actually.
That's right. Yeah, no, you do. I think it's pretty cool. And yeah, obviously we talk a lot about, you know, U.S. and North America kind of, well, and South America. But yeah, we haven't focused. We've had a few U.K. episodes. And I'd love to hear, because, you know, you've got both of them covered, right? So when you talk about, let's just stick on the nymph fishing game, you know, is there a big difference between nymphing, say, in the UK versus nymphing out in some of the rivers you've hit in the US?
Not really. I remember, you know, again, on that first trip out to Colorado, that I was fishing the frying pan one day, and I suspect many of the people, you know, or the one person listening to this program, you know, when I'm on it, will say, oh, I know the Colorado. I know the frying pan, but yeah, it was astonishing to me that people weren't fishing nymphs. I mean, they would now, but they weren't then. And I said, well, I'll try these nymphs. I mean, surely they probably won't work, but I'll try. And it was like, you know, it was really just ridiculously simple, actually. But, subsequently, yeah, I mean, nymph fishing, it's a huge part of what we do over in the UK.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. But we're still hidebound by rules. I mean, there are a number of areas that I fish about 20 minutes, 30 minutes from where I'm talking to you now that are only allowing dry fly at this particular point of the season.
Yeah.
They don't allow nymph fishing, and you have to live with that. Yeah. Otherwise, you get banned. It's as simple as that.
Well, why is that rule there?
If you can come up with a good idea, I have no idea myself, so I'm open to anyone that's got a good suggestion. I don't know, because years ago when we had massive insect hatches, it was realistic. I mean, you had good large dark olive, which is abated right from the get-go. They would hatch off when it was snowy, when it was raining, when it was hail, you know, typical sort of early season weather for us. But now those hatches have just dwindled away to virtually nothing, Dave. I mean, you know, we've just had a program on our national TV on a program called Panorama, who centered on the state of our rivers and the amount of raw sewage going in them. Well, yeah, I mean, we have got a real problem in this country, and we've got to face it, but it's all endemic to the reason why we haven't got the sort of hatches that we used to have that would create a dry fly only position at the beginning of a season, because you didn't want to disturb the fish too much. So you were putting this artificial barrier, I suppose, on what you did. Now, when you've got a situation like that now, of course, you're virtually not catching anything. So
yeah.
You've got to rely on nymphs. So whether the rules will change to accommodate it or not, I don't know. Gotcha. Let's hope. Let's hope.
Okay. Yeah, I always think of that. That's what I think of, you know, and I haven't been there and fish, and I definitely will look forward to getting there. I know.
No,
I'm going to get there.
You have an open invitation. When we can travel, you have an open invitation to come and fish.
There you go. All right, perfect. So, but I always think of it just in my mind, you know, because you hear all the, you know, the dry fly fishing and then, you know, obviously wet flies, that's kind of all you think of. And, you know, I think, at least I don't ever think of nymph fishing in the UK, but yeah, it sounds like you do quite a bit of it over there.
Well, we do because, you know, it's a natural progression to catching fish. I mean, you don't really want to turn up. No one wants to turn up onto a river and actually not catch anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the point of that? But, you know, there's a lot of times when actually a dry fly, I'm very well positioned where I am here in it's southern England. It's not far from the coast, the south coast. It's not far from Salisbury, but I've got easy access to Wales. I've got easy access to chalk streams. I've got easy access to the West Country, where the rivers are incredibly different. They're mostly moorland, freestone rivers, where, you know, your usual, you know, parachute Adams or a, you know, well-presented hackle dry fly will bring fish up because they're hungry and they're eager to rise. So there's no real need to use a nymph. Yes, you can use a hopper-dropper style of fishing, but there's absolutely the joy is actually just fishing these places that look as though they've come out of Rivendell.
Gotcha.
And you know, just picking pockets with dry flies. It's great fun. But on the more sedate rivers, you know, the Welsh Usk, for instance, we've got amazingly good still hatches of Granum, the early season caddis. Mm-hmm. And you can fish a dry fly pretty confidently most days, actually. So it's not all doom and gloom. It's just that on many of the chalk streams, it is. And I'd much rather use a shrimp, a scud, or a nymph, really, to give me an opportunity of fish, if nothing else.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I wanted to, before we dig into more of the kind of the tips and some of that stuff, I want to touch base on you because I know... You know, your background, I've heard some names thrown around about, you know, how you're the lefty Cray of the UK and all these all these amazing things. But so I want to hear how you got started. So take us back. Let's go back to your actually before you started fly fishing. How did that come to be?
Well, I was dragged screaming, Dave, into fishing by my father at the age of about 3 or 4. I didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
I mean, had I taken up any other type of sport, I would have been I wouldn't be here talking to you, I don't think. But I was really fortunate because I was born into a family that loved fishing. I was born into an age that actually accommodated fishing. And so, you know, my father had a little tiny chalk stream in Kent. And we used to look after it. We used to just tender it. I mean, and for those not necessarily understanding what a chalk stream is, it's very much like a limestone river would be in Pennsylvania.
Mm.
So if you look at the Latours, the Yellow Britches or something like that, you've got it.
Yeah.
Or even better still, anyone that's fished in Paradise Valley will get, you know, when you're fishing Dupuis or any of those, that is pretty much the type of water I grew up and have always carried on fishing. So clear, wary trout, and I was grown up on that, and my father immersed me in this wonderful world. And of course, he had the gear of the time, so he had, you know, the Hardy fly rods and reels and silk lines, and you know, it was just I didn't really want to do anything else,
really.
Not really.
Yeah.
As soon as I picked up a fly rod and felt it, and felt the movement of line and the way the rod moved with the line and vice versa, I just didn't want to do anything else. And it's pretty much clouded my judgment.
did you ever have along the way, any sorts of breaks where you kind of like, well, I need to take a break from fly fish and this is kind of a little, you know, a little too much?
Not really. I mean, I was, and I, this is down on record, and I think probably in the vaults or somewhere, there's probably proof of it. I was the worst rock and roll singer in the history of mankind.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Well, not nice for anyone listening to me, not nice at all. But yeah, I was on the road with a band for a few years. And
what was the name of the group?
Oh, we were called, we had various names to accommodate various venues, but we were Hundred Weight, we were this, we were that. We ended up being Rats at the end of the day.
That's all. I love that you say this, Charles. This is I just was.
Yes, my dodgy part. And this has never come out.
This
public.
Is perfect. This
I've
is perfect.
Run from it like a scalded cat.
We got to dig into it. And I know you have a podcast as well, so I know you can appreciate the podcasting space. But I'm a podcast. I always love to joke about it. I'm kind of an addict. I listen to podcasts. I produce them. I do everything. But I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts right now. It's called Smartless. And these guys were interviewing Sir, so, you know, they're interviewing Sir Paul McCartney, right?
Oh, right.
Yeah, okay. So Paul was on. And I've never really listened to Paul on an interview really close, but, you know, I mean, he's just a normal guy. He's a totally normal guy. He actually doesn't like the stuff, but it's, you know, obviously one of the greatest bands, maybe the greatest band of all time. So you got the Beatles, right? So you got the Beatles. Now, were you thinking, was that what got you going in music? Or
no, I've always been, I remember our roadie saying, can we have everything louder than everything else, which is a classic, you know, sort of rock and roll thing. And, you know, we were Marshall stacks, lots of ampage, lots of noise, lots of everything. And, you know, it was honestly, Dave, it was the best couple of years of my life. Oh, I mean, cool. It was amazing. But touring with you know, people that wouldn't necessarily be known in America, it was extraordinary. But there were bands like UFO and people like that who did actually and were heard of in the States.
What instrument did you play?
I was a singer. I couldn't play a thing. I could barely sing. I could, you know, I could just about, my timing was okay, really. Yeah. That was about the head of it. And it was a period where actually you were a front man and all the rest of it. And I had long curly hair. And so that was a plus. it sort of went downhill from there, really.
Yeah. So this is like heavy metal.
Yeah, it was. It was just out and out rock, and you know, it was great fun. But the irony in all this, the absolute incredible irony, is the people that I used to watch back then, I fished with subsequently. And, you know, I would never have been able to do that had I not fished, and I fished the entire time. And it's a very strange sort of Volta Farsa thing. But I wouldn't have, but throughout it, I fished.
Yeah,
you know, there was this kid with hair halfway down his back, sort of long blonde curly head, you know, so dancing around on the riverbank. It was the most bizarre thing. I mean, it was so bad, Dave. I've got to tell you this, that my mother saw me walking down Canterbury High Street and actually was with a friend and walked onto the other side of the road to avoid introducing me to, yeah, it was that bad.
That's
but it
good.
Was fun. Oh,
that's
Lord,
good.
It's fun. Yeah.
So basically, yeah, you started out as, you know, as far back as you can remember, and you've been fly fishing your whole time. So how did you get to be where you're, you know, you've written all these books, and it sounds like it kind of became a more than just a pastime. You did it for, you know, what you do.
Yeah, it was luck, really. I guess, you know, I've always painted. My father was an artist. I've painted. He used to write a little bit, and I've always loved the written word as well. And, you know, I've been fortunate. I've been incredibly lucky. I mean, I was able to write for the Daily Telegraph, the London Telegraph, on fishing, and from that went on to something else, which went on to something else, which went on to something else. And it's just been a roller coaster, and it's never really stopped. It's been the most wonderful journey. It really has. It's been extraordinary.
That's cool. Yeah, no, I love hearing the stories. That's more, I mean, even for me, more than the tips and stuff, I love just hearing kind of how everybody kind of came into it. And I mean, I'm sure there's lots of people over there that are doing what you do, right, out of your area.
Yeah, but you have to work. I mean, I would say this, that you don't get anywhere. I mean, yes, luck has a role and a significant one, but you've got to work at it too. I mean, you can't just rest on your laurels. I mean, it's like in any other sphere of life, you're only as good as the last thing that you produce. So you're always looking to top that. So the cast that I made yesterday, I want to better today, or the technique that you develop, you know, tomorrow should be bettered by the one coming after that one, and so forth and so on. So it's a continual process of trying to reach and attain more and more each time. So you never let up, never let up.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect. I want to highlight, you know, Cam is a person who listens to this podcast, and he reached out to me. And he actually noted, he was like, you have to get Charles on the podcast. And this is, you know, one of the great things about, I found my success, you know, and the success of this podcast has been by listening to people who listen to the show, right? So whenever I can, yeah, I get people on. So I appreciate Cam for reaching out. He was interested just in, you know, talking a little more about your journey and kind of, you know, how you've gone along from nymphs to wet flies to dry flies. I mean, do you pretty much, have you always done a little bit of everything, or have you focused?
Yeah, I have. I mean, I think the biggest change for me, the area in the road that became not just a crossroads, almost a roundabout, was when I moved from rivers to still water. And I know that still water and lake fishing is still very much in its infancy, I think, in United States. There's still this slight ambivalence about, you know, should I do this, should I not? Will they still talk to me if I, you know? But for me, that's been a real, real adventure, because there's so many layers, so many differences, and it does make you a better fisher. It makes you a better caster. You have to cast distances. If you're dry fly fishing, you have to be able to read the movement of fish. You have to know rise forms. Are they coming up from deep? Are they sitting underneath the surface, you know, gulping, as you would have, say, on some of the western lakes? So for me, it's been a real area of interest and intrigue, actually. So that's altered an awful lot. So I brought quite a bit of what I've learned on Stillwater to fishing on rivers, because, you know, we're using incredibly long leaders sometimes. I mean, the shortest leader I'll ever use on a still water is probably 18 feet.
Yeah.
And that's the shortest. So, you know, for me, using a 12 or a 16 or a, you know, whatever foot leader on a river is nothing, you know, it's what I do normally. Yeah, I think it's that's where the big change was. I think if you sit in one area of your fishing, yes, you get very good at it, but I think you're losing the opportunity in a lot of other areas too.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, we've talked a little bit about lake fishing. We've had some, you know, Phil Roy was on in a past podcast, and I'm hoping to dig more into it. But I feel like anybody that's new to fly fishing and that, you know, hasn't tried lake fishing or still waters or whatever should do it, because it's amazing. You know, I mean, it's a whole different world. It's like, you know, you're out there, it's almost more meditative, you know what I mean? In a certain extent. Do you guys, we talked, you know, the lock style, is that pretty much when you talk about still waters, is that something you
know, we fish on bank as well. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'll fish it all. Lock style, when you fish lock style has got so many interpretations now. I mean, it's basically how you position a boat. Yeah. On a lake, really. I mean, thereafter, it's very different to how lock style evolved, which is three or four flies stroke through the surface. They still do it in Ireland. They still do it in Scotland. And we still do it in England, too, and Wales. But essentially, nowadays, it's basically the way I've always likened it to people is it's a game of three-dimensional chess or drafts or checkers. Where you've got the surface and then you've got all the layers underneath it. And it's how you read, you know, where those fish are in the water column that determines your success. Yeah. And knowing about lines, sink rates, the whole lot. I mean, right. you are not one dimensional. If you're fishing a lake, you should never be one dimensional. And, You know, yes, you can do it the lazy way. And I'm going to say the lazy way. Yes, you can put out a sight indicator or a suspension device, if you prefer, and hang something off the end of it and just wait. Well, yeah, that's kind of ambushing. And it's not, you know, it's got its place. And I'd be the first to put a newcomer on that to get them into fish. But it's not what it's about. You know, if you... We've developed ways of fishing very small nymphs, and, you know, I say small, I mean comparatively size 10s, 12s, 14s, and depths of up to 40 feet. And using, strangely enough, I mean, just using styles that, you know, we've adopted from bass fishers from anywhere that we can find that would actually get us down to where those fish sometimes are because of, you know, very cold weather or very hot weather, where the oxygen is. So it's still a growing, it's still a wonderful area to still discover. You know, that's what I like about it. There's still stuff to discover.
And like I said, we're going to do more Stillwater episodes as we go. So that's great. Maybe we can just dig in. I wanted to focus a little bit on the nymph fishing, you know, and I'm not sure when you think of nymph fishing, is it Euro nymphing now for you, or how do you describe it? I mean, how would you describe to somebody your style?
Crikey. I mean, I don't think, you know, as somebody that fishes and you've got a river in front of you, I don't think you can fall into a style.
Yeah.
I think you meet the river for what it's suggesting on that day. And for you to have a specific style is limiting the opportunities that you have, quite frankly.
Yeah.
So I would suggest to anyone that you actually understand not just one particular component of the sport, but lots of them. And so you can adjust, and you might bring in one from one area and into the other. I mean, there's all sorts of interpretations of Euro nymphing. I mean, you know, French nymphing is, you know, I've never seen anything so bent out of shape as French nymphing. I mean, I've seen the French nymph and they pick a fish, a very scary, anyone that's fished in France will know this. I mean, those fish fear for their lives, even a passing shadow, for goodness sake. I mean, they are so tricky to catch. And those fishers will actually use incredibly long leaders on very light, long rods and cast very small weighted patterns upstream of that flight. It's upstream nymphing to the highest possible degree. That's French nymphing.
Yep.
Nowadays, it's meant to casting out a little bit further than you would tight lining, i.e. Czech nymphing or Polish nymphing, and doing, you know, basically fixed lining at range. Well, that's not French nymphing. You know, French nymphing is an entirely different, very, very subtle thing indeed.
That's interesting, because when you say that, it's hard. I kind of tend to lump things. But so French nymphing, the difference between French nymphing and, say, a Polish nymphing style is what is the big difference?
Well, one is done at range to observe species, whereas say Czech or Polish nymphing or tightline nymphing is done almost, you know, underneath your rod.
Right, in close.
One, two, or three flies, just on a very tight line. So it's cast upstream of you. It's always in control. You've got control of it. You can move it up or down the water column as you see fit.
Yeah.
And then away you go. Whereas the classic, and I'm going to say the classic because you don't often see it done, it's very difficult to do. French nymphing is where that species, that quarry, is observed. You've marked it. You've marked its position. It's like dry fly fishing, only subsurface, really, for a very, very difficult fish. So, that's where I see, you know, things a little bit, you know, the terms used in a much broader sense than perhaps they were intended.
Let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. OPST's Micro Series has been designed to pleasantly accommodate both single-hand and two-handed waterborne casts. Sporting single-weld upper grips, switch-style lower handles, a medium-fast action, and a short length, that makes almost anything possible.
I've been swinging flies for trout with this this lovely rod with the Micro Series lately, and it's been really amazing. In fact, on my last dry fly trip, I actually put the Skagit line away, grabbed an old reel with a 5-weight line. I think it was a weight forward line. Tossed that on this rod, and it casted. How did it cast? It was like a dream. Lots of power and a super delicate touch. It kind of feels like this rod pretty much does it all. So this is pretty amazing stuff. Whether you are swinging soft tackles, throwing heavy articulated streamers, or busting bushy salmon flies into the teeth of an afternoon breeze, these nifty little hybrid rods should have a permanent place in your quiver. Head over to wetflyswing.com/OPST to get it started right now. That's wetflyswing.com/OPST. Okay, let's get back to the show.
I know you've written a number of books. One of them is I think it's the Sothersby Guide to Fly Fishing.
Sothersby. Classic guide, yeah.
Yeah. Can you describe that book to somebody who hasn't read it? Because I know it's a pretty damn good book, right?
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, it was done a long, long time ago now, but it was done primarily as an immersion into the sport. That here was a book that you could have in a pictorial sense, and it's done very much. It was one of the first to break the mold in terms of how you offered your product or your way of operating to the reader. Whereas before there were lots and lots of words and a few pictures. Here were a lot of pictures and very much fewer words. Excuse me.
Yeah.
And so consequently, it's heavily loaded towards illustration, to photographs, to all sorts of areas that give you a visual impact, not just necessarily a reading impact. So you've got both elements. And it was really to introduce the sport on its widest route. Lots of flies, a bit of casting instruction, a bit on fly tying.
Did you cover nymph fishing?
A lot on nymph fishing. And I was really fortunate because we had a big budget on the book. I was able to go across Europe and to many extent, some of the flies there, if you look at the date, there are gold heads there before anyone was putting gold heads into books. And CDC patterns are in there. And before people were really turning on to CDC. So we had that real fabulous opportunity to bring what was then the cutting edge of Europe into a book on an international stage. And it's done very well. I mean, it would need updating now because there's an awful lot of stuff there that has been improved on and has moved on.
Yeah.
But in essence, it's still one of few, I would have said. I mean, it sounds terribly grandstanding, doesn't it? But it's one of few that actually offers the sport in its entirety, and enough, or there's sufficient there to get you your first fish in that type of way.
So if somebody was, say, in the US and they picked that book up right now, would that help them if they were brand new to fishing? Would that help them get into it?
Absolutely. And they could come over to the UK and fish on a still water and catch fish, or they could go to a loch in Scotland and catch a fish, and or they could go on to the Madison and catch a fish.
Yeah.
That's the idea of it. Now, they may want to progress. They might want to then go on and get one of Gary's books or whoever.
Yeah.
But in essence, it doesn't do anything in a very specific way. It sort of dips in, it gives you an overview, and then it comes out and says, right, if you want to know more, go and concentrate on, and specialize in that area.
Gotcha. And I want to talk a little more about some of the other books that you've been a part of, but I'm just curious, as far as what has changed. So if you look at that book when you published it, I mean, you probably don't remember everything in it or whatever, but is there anything that's changed if you focus on the nymphing since you wrote it to now, and what has been the big?
Yeah, I think, certainly the upstream styles haven't changed. I would say that the significant area of change would be the tight lining, the almost total infatuation with fixed line fishing. And, you know, it wasn't the lovely George Daniel. I mean, I'm sure you've had George on your show, and who I think is just a breath of fresh air in our sport. I really, really do. Mm-hmm. He's one of the most decent men I've ever come across, but he's one of the most competent anglers I've ever come across. But he brought out dynamic nymphing, and you know, he really did codify everything. I mean, if anyone wants to do nymphing, I'm going to come away from my book, because if anyone wants to understand nymph fishing, then get George's book, because it really is a tour de force. It truly is.
And he doesn't, and I love his book too. I don't even know if he calls it Euro nymphing, right? He doesn't want to even focus at that. It's just, like you're saying, it's just nymph fishing, right? It's his style.
Yeah, I think it, I mean, you know, Euro nymphing's only just been adopted the last few years because I think it was put on the base of fly rods to sell them. And my goodness me, that's done
that works.
Probably well, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
That's worked. Yeah, I think it's been codified by or created by the industry more than the angler, as so often is the case. But it does. It's a nice embracive term to describe a variety of techniques which fall under the same canopy, which is basically fixed line fishing. It's basically high sticking, really. When it all gets down to it, it's high sticking. You know, if you look at the lines, crikey, I mean, they're as thin as a wisp. I mean, you know, I'm using, when I'm fishing for grayling, which I think you do have occasionally in some of your rivers and lakes, you know, I'm using braid. I'm using, you know, bass fisher's braid, because I want a higher, you know, I want that feel as those flies go through the water column. Hmm. Not always, but sometimes. And we've got lines now that are so thin that aren't really, you know, they don't have a weight, as we know. And they're emulating that braid. So it's where fly fishing, there is an argument to be said here, Dave. Is it fly fishing?
Yeah.
Because
you're casting.
Yeah. I mean, but I do use the rods that I would use for that style when I'm dry fly fishing. And I do use some of those very, very thin fly lines when the fish are very nervous, because they just don't create a shadow. They don't hit the water with the degree of impact, and it's a very, very effective way of fishing a dry fly.
Yeah.
So one can actually lead to another.
Yeah.
You know, you're just going to be open-minded, and that's what fly fishing is. So don't get stuck in a Euro nymphing mode. You know, look to break out of it. You know, because at the end of the day, Dave, I find it incredibly boring. Popping a fly up there and watching it tumble down towards me, fish below, and then repeating it up through a riffle or a run or wherever. It's really effective, but I just find it dull, actually.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I think that's the best way. Yeah. Keep mixing it up and do a little of everything. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not fishing with a smile on your face, don't do it.
That's right. That's right. Nice. So yeah, I guess, you know, I think there's a lot of ways we could take this. I would like to touch again on your books. Can you just talk?
Yeah.
Do you have a book, or have you worked on a book focused on nymph fishing specifically?
No, I haven't. Not specifically. And I think there are others better equipped to do it.
Didn't you work on? I don't know if you. I thought I heard you had like worked with somebody who had produced a Euro nymphing book or something like that, or you'd help.
I've done. You see, that's the thing. I've done an awful lot of illustrations for people.
Oh, illustrations, right?
Yeah, I've done a lot for people in the Czech Republic. They've used a lot of my stuff. Shiri Klima, who is widely regarded as being the father of Czech nymphing, now he really is by. If you want a stunningly effective fly fisher, Jiří Klíma for me is it. I mean, all right, we've got lots of really good guys now, but when you think, you know, he basically came up with the whole idea of how you and where you put your flies in relationship to the other and how they fish in the water column and the reaction and what have you. I watched that man check nymph or you know, tight line down a riffle that could barely come up to your knee with a you know, everyone thinks you use a 10-foot rod. He was using something like an 8-foot rod because he said, that's what I do, because, you know, why use a 10-foot rod in an area that is not equipped for a 10-foot rod?
Yeah.
You know, point made. So, you know, he would check nymph even through a little tiny run of that, and he just caught fish after fish after fish. But, you know, it was his way of operating was so efficient, so clever, but it was all in how those flies fished and their relationship to one another on the leader and where they were positioned. That's what intrigued me. It's a high science, it's a high art. And, you know, there are people out there that like George who really understand that. There are a number of others. I mean, you've got some wonderful, Devin Olsen is another one. I mean, Devin understands it. I remember fishing with Devin on the Lower Henry's Fork. And we had a whale of a time, but that time it was soft hackles, ironically, and we were fishing upstream to fish in the classic way. But he's always been an absolute vacuum cleaner for information. I've never seen anything like it. I talk about the ultimate angling sponge. I mean, he is. I mean, he just soaks up this information and then brings it to the fore in brilliance. He's a very fine fisher. And there is so many. You've got, you know, talk about the golden age of American fly fishers. You really have. I mean, but they're coming into this competition world of where, you know, it's about catching fish. It's about work rate. It is about, you know, sort of really taking on a stretch of water and making every single bit of it count. And that's not for everybody,
right?
You know, it just isn't.
No, I know. I think, and actually I've got, Tactical Fly Fishing, Devin's book right here sitting next
to
me.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's
been on a couple times as well. So,
but if you look at that book, Dave,
yeah,
it's fascinating because if you look at the amount of patterns in there are very, very few.
Yeah.
Actually,
it's true.
But it's how they're fished. We're back to how it's fishing rather than what you're fishing.
Yeah.
And this was, we're actually going back in time to where Sawyer started. It wasn't
the
complication of his patterns. Basic. It was the simplicity and how they were fished.
Yeah.
Not what fished.
Huh. So the pheasant tail obviously the pheasant tail is pheasant tail. I mean, literally it's like you said, but when that came out, what did the other nymphs, you know, what did they look like? Were they, like you said, were they just a wet fly with a little bit of thorax? That's all it was? Or how were they?
I used to, when I was guiding, you know, in those dim and distant days, I used to use Margaret Sawyer's flies. She used to tie them for us. And, you know, that they were exactly as Frank intended. There were bits of feather with lots of copper wire on them. That was it.
Yeah.
And I now kick myself for how many I gave away, how many I left in trees, how many I did this, because I haven't got a one to this.
No
day,
kidding.
So none. But they were so simple. It just is proof. You can create the most complicated thing on the planet and spend hours at the vise, or you can do the simple thing and then go fish.
Exactly. No, this is great. This is great, Charles. I think, I want to touch on your art here in a little bit and also get more of the, you know, the tips and stuff. But I didn't want to miss the podcast because obviously I love the podcasting. And you guys have a podcast, right? The fishing cast?
I do a number.
But
Simon and I, yes, we've moved on, darling. We've moved
on. Oh, really?
On.
Oh, yeah. I was wondering because, you know, I could tell you, I was just listening to that.
We're vlogging. It's terrifying. We're actually doing these things live and we can see people. It's terrifying, you know, because we take on issues that really we shouldn't at our age take on. I mean, you know, it's not good for the heart.
Like, well, is this politics or conservation?
No, it's mostly about should you be fishing streamers on chalk streams, and if you're going to divide a room and get death in the camp, that's going to be it. you know, yeah. Kelly Gallup,
yeah,
would probably, Kelly is just what people forget about. Sorry, I'm dancing off at another tangent again.
Go for it.
But what people forget about Kelly is he's one of the best nymph and dry fly fishes you'll ever find on the Madison. Yet he's only seems to be known for his rather curiously named streamers. But
Well, what's your take? I'm curious on that, Charles, because I don't get into the obviously I don't talk about politics or religion, you know, ever on here. But you know, I love Kelly. Kelly's been on here a couple times.
We
built a good friendship as well. But he was recently called out over here by a very another friend of mine who I know, and he called him out and said, you know what, we need to stop using those derogatory names. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, you know, the man's entitled to call a fly what he wants.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people, my parents and many others fought, and this is going to sound really, you know, dark, but they fought in world wars, as many people's parents did,
yep,
and others have subsequently, for a thing called freedom of speech. Now, I'm the most liberal person going. I really am. But I haven't got a problem with it. The more you point a finger, an accusational finger at something, the more the problem becomes exacerbated because you draw attention to it.
Exactly.
Now, who cares? I mean, really, who cares? Did the trout that was caught on, you know, a sex dungeon, yes, I've said it, really care whether it was caught on that fly or not? I mean, you know, what you call it it doesn't make sense to me. I'm living in a politically sensitive world that seems to be running almost fearful of itself, Dave.
Yeah. Do you find that over there? Because I obviously...
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, so it's pretty politically... You have to be politically correct or you get in trouble.
Yeah, no. You know, you really have to watch your P's and Q's. I mean, you really do. I have to be very careful when I write something. Oh, gosh, if someone reads this in this way, what are they going to think? Instead of saying, well, you know, print and be damned. You know, nowadays you're going, oh, I'm not sure I can say that.
Right, because everything, you know, everything's recorded too nowadays, right? That's the thing. That's the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, literally every, like you're saying, you're doing the vlogging, but this is being recorded. There's going to be... We're going to actually have a transcript of this entire podcast, right? So there's going to be a whole written document of
absolutely.
It. So it's pretty
and
amazing.
Someone will, the depressing thing is that someone will probably pore over it and look for some little tiny chink that we did, either of us, and call us out on it. You know, I remember, you know, going back to that book, I remember putting out, running parallel contiguously to that was a book called Dark Pools, which I loved. I mean, it was me. It was about, you know, growing up on chalk streams, da-da-da-da-da. It's out of print now, but it was my soul, that book. And I had this four-page letter. Remember it, four-page letter telling me that I'd put a comma in the wrong place.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, oh, wow.
Gosh.
And I thought, you've missed the point here, buddy. Yeah. You really have. And
that's crazy.
So... I'm aware that there are people out there that actually do nothing else but want to look for something and denigrate what others have done. And I'm so tired of that.
Yeah.
You know, none of us gets it right all the time. I get it wrong most of the time.
Yep.
But I don't want people to constantly remind me of me getting it wrong, frankly. I know when I've made a mistake. I know when I've screwed up.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's have some levity. Let's have some kindness.
Yeah. You know what I find, Charles? And I totally agree with you. I actually look at our example today, the way this podcast, remember, I screwed up yesterday, right? I thought we were going on a day early. Right. And I was like, oh my gosh, I actually thought it was your fault. And I could have wrote something, you know what I mean? And said, man, Charles, what are you doing here, buddy? Who's going to skip out? Right. But I was wrong. I was wrong, and I never said anything about it because that's the way I am. I don't really say stuff because I just feel like, you know. And it turned out that you were the right. I was wrong, right? So it's like,
well, but the thing is that who was going to win over that? If I'd made a mistake, I would have been absolutely appalled. I've been felt so bad.
Yeah.
And you know, this is it. That most people know when they've made a mistake. Most people feel pretty bad about that mistake. To be continually reminded of that mistake is unworthy, frankly.
Yeah.
And I get very upset by this. And you know, if Kelly wants to call a fly that he's created, that he's come up with, that he's fished, that he's made, you know, through his genius, and that's the right word.
Yep.
Why he should, you know, if he wants to call it, you know, Ermentrude, why not? You know?
Yeah. I love that. No, I love that. I think it's, you know, and I remember when it came out because I was friends with both of these guys, and I was like, gosh, I guess I'm kind of in the middle. Yeah. I mean, it feels like, you know, I kind of agreed with what you're saying there. So yeah, we'll leave it at that, but I appreciate you kind of shedding some light on that. I did want to back to the podcast because I love, again, the podcast. So you have this show. So are you saying you have the Fishing Cast and then you have another podcast, or is
no, well, it sort of evolved. I mean, we are trying to do both, but we're finding it's, you know, because you know how much time it takes. And you know, I'm a working chap, just same as Simon is.
Yeah.
We kind of just take topics, and it's sort of evolved because people really wanted to get involved. So you've got, you know, 500 people, you know, in front of you and live, and you go, oh, I better not mess up here. And it's really like jumping out of airplanes without parachutes. Yeah, it is. It kind of is. It's like being back on stage again.
Yeah. So in that cast, so basically what you do is, and I haven't watched the video, but basically
you got to.
Yeah, okay. So I'll put a link out to that video and I'll take a look. So you basically you take the audio and then you post that onto your podcast.
Yeah.
So that's the Fishing Cast.
That's it.
Keep doing that because I think
We will.
Yeah, I've been listening to it and just kind of in the background, and that's why podcasting's great, right? Because you can just listen as you're going, and I love the dialogue between you and Simon. You know what I mean? Like it's really fun and entertaining. Who is Simon, and like how did you connect? Is he like an old friend?
Okay, Simon's a very old friend, and Simon is a very very well received author. I mean, in a proper circle. I mean, he's written books on racehorses and otters and chalk streams and all sorts of things. And you know, he's really quite a celebrated chap. But he runs a very very good company called Fishing Breaks, which leases water to day rods. So if somebody was coming from America. Not that they can at the moment, and I can't come over there, which is a huge frustration, but they could book up with Simon and fish bits of the test, bits of the itching, so forth and so on. So he concentrates primarily, not entirely, but primarily on the southern chalk streams. And so he does leases, so you know, you can go in there and get your, and I've worked with Simon in the past, and he also hosts, and this is coming up, he got the idea, he fished the Jackson Hole one fly, which you'll probably know. And he's brought that to the River Test and the Itchen and the southern chalk streams. And we do it too, in a very different way, because it's got to be, you know, very carefully maneuvered and manipulated, because you bring in riparian owners and so forth. And we've just got to know one another over the years. And because we're incredibly different in character, I think it kind of works. I mean, you know, I tend to come from a much more angling immersed background, whereas I think it's fair to say that Simon comes from a learned background, and from the more business side of fly fishing. So it's a very intriguing mix, actually. And we don't mind taking on topics.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, you guys take on some good. I think one of them was the North versus the South, right?
Yeah. Oh, that was interesting. and I always end up with the sort of short straw, but don't mind that. I don't mind that at all. You know,
that's good.
Yeah. But they're fun.
That's good. Well, keep it up.
Oh, we definitely will. Definitely will.
Awesome. All right. Well, before, you know, there's obviously, we haven't dug in. This has been great because we've dug in a lot of your background. I love that. But I did want to touch on, again, going back to nymphing. So let's talk about just today. So if you were going out today to your stream that's 30 minutes away and you were going to be nymph fishing, can you talk about your setup, what you would be using? Maybe just start us with a leader and stuff like that.
Well, it depends on which river I went, because I've got a number of rivers I could actually go at. But if I said went to one, it's quite clear. But it's quite small. It's the River Frome, which is just outside of Dorchester. It's overlooked. If anyone has got any idea of literature, it's Thomas Hardy has got had his cottage there. That backdrop has changed very little in the hundreds of years, really. But the rivers there are absolutely gin clear. And you can count every pebble, you know, every bit of wavering, water weed, you know, it's incredible. And the fish are so shy. So I would probably, if I couldn't use a 10-foot two weight, I would probably use a 9-foot three weight. That would be my go-to, I think. And then I would use a very somber colored fly line. I would use a leader that was possibly, I would say between 14 and 18 foot in length, dropping down to about 6X tippet. Mm-hmm. I'd have, beginning of the season, I'd probably have a bit of flash, so a gold or a silver head, maybe a gray pattern or you know, a dear old pheasant tail, actually. Little copper-headed pheasant tail or something like that. And just fish the runs. But what we do, there is a product used by what we call course fishers, who fish for the smaller silver fish, and they fish matches. And in order to meet the changing light conditions that they find, and they use bobbers, floats, they paint the antennae. They have a paint that's created, I think, in France, that looks like correction fluid, only coloured, okay, if you're with me here. And you can paint your leader with this, actually, and you can paint it bright fluorescent yellow or fluorescent red or black or white or whatever you want. And I would paint my leader so I could see it. And so I would have a clear section of maybe about 8 to 12 feet, tapering down to, as I say, about 6X. And then I probably put in these little markers. I wouldn't want to put an indicator in because it's too bulbous. I wouldn't want to put a, you know, great big, you know, bit of, you know, half a sheep in there, so it bobbed down the current. I wouldn't want to do that. I'd want accuracy because I'll be observing my quarry. So I'd work upstream, and any likely area I would just cast and maybe fish between the weed beds and what have you. But I would be casting upstream, so I'd grease up that lead. I'd grease up my fly line so it floated, and I would grease down to this coloured section and just fish those nymphs. And if I saw that coloured section hesitate, drift across the current, dip under, I would lift at any slight sign at all. And that's how I would adopt. So I'd look for my quarry. If I couldn't see them, you know, you'd always know that if I was fishing in Colorado or I was fishing in Dorset, it would make no difference. Those fish live the edge of seams, just where it's nice and easy, or just at the front of a pool or at the back of the pool, where there's the most food coming towards them. So fish are fish. So you instinct will guide you to those places. And so that's what I would adopt. And I would keep everything really, really simple. I mean, I don't overcomplicate it. Now, I'm saying one fly because we pretty much would be restricted to one fly this time of year.
Oh, right.
So, you know, if I wasn't, then I would definitely use what we call clink and dink or hopper dropper. So I'd have a clink hammer or something on a dropper. I don't tie off that bend of the hook. I always have a dropper because they're very often going to come up and nail that. And I found that fish coming up and taking a fly with nylon wrapped around the bend of the hook tend not to take as well. So I have a dropper, and then I'd have that nymph coming off it maybe 18 inches or thereabouts after that. And that's a great search way. And, you know, again, if I couldn't use a 10-foot rod, I would use a 9-foot. I would cast maybe about 2 rod lengths out and just fish that down through likely lies. And that I found incredibly effective if I can do it, if I'm allowed to do it, which I would be in Wales.
So, yeah, which you would be. Yeah. And what is the what's the dropper knot you would use on that?
I use a surgeon's knot, actually.
Okay.
And just use the downward facing bit, not the upward facing. Everyone goes, oh, look, there's a bit sticking up and it won't.
Yeah.
You don't do that. That's a nasty hinge and it'll break. Use the downward facing one and keep it about 4 inches long.
Okay.
Not much longer, but not much shorter either, because if you need to change, you won't have anything to change to. So, that's what I would do. And then just hanging off there. But there are all sorts of cunning devices that I've come up with down the years, which involve tying in a section through a fly. And you can slide that fly up and down that nylon section. And so you can adjust your depth as you go along a pool or a shallow, whatever, and you can still fish your nymphs. So you don't have to change, you know, tippets or anything. You just move the position of that floating fly. And it's something I saw first done by a wonderful Italian fly dresser called Oscar Palou, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago. And he was the most innovative fly tyer I've ever come across in my entire life. Incredible.
How do you spell his last name?
P-A, it's either two L's or one, and I can never remember which, but it's P-A-L-L-U, Palou.
Oh, okay, Palou, gotcha.
Yeah, Oscar Palou, fantastic.
Let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Turtlebox is the loudest, truly portable, waterproof Bluetooth speaker available. Perfect for a skiff, drift boat, or your craft of choice. The guys at Turtlebox believe in respecting the peace and beauty while on the water, but listening to great tunes before or after can be amazing. The features I love most on this one are the quality bulletproof frame, easy to push and lighted buttons, and at home you can add another speaker for stereo. To be honest, I've been using this speaker quite a bit around the home, and the dance party with the kids has been great. Find out why Turtlebox is our go-to speaker and why it is great for the river as well. Head over to wetflyswing.com/turtlebox to support a great company, this podcast, and some tunes.
Okay, now let's get back to the show.
And can you remind me again what you're talking about there about adjusting the fly?
Okay, you're tying a fly, okay? So you've got a fly, you've got a hook in the vise, and then you put on the hook shank some foam. It's really important that you put some foam on the hook shank, because that's the sort of almost the gripping part of it. And then before you've built anything else of the fly, you tie in a section of nylon, you know, be it 8 pounds, 9 pounds, 10 pounds, and you put a little tiny 1.5 mil or 2 mil little ring one side and one the other, when after you've tied the fly, of course. So you put in that section and then you build up, it could be a stimulator, it could be all sorts of things, but you just build up your fly on top of that setup. And that way, when you move that fly, when you've bound that nylon into the dressing, you've actually made it part of the entire fly, so you can move it up and down.
All right.
Are you with me?
Yep.
And it's a really effective way of accommodating depth very quickly.
Huh. That's cool. And you're saying this Palou, he's the guy that kind of created this.
Oh, way ahead of any of us. I mean, he came up with a polyphytis nymph where you actually put a bead on a pin and just had it proud of the dressing. Oh, it's just all sorts of stuff.
Where could you find that thing? Is there like a video or any resource out there where somebody could?
Look, the best thing, if anyone's really intrigued about it, I've got some photographs of it somewhere. It cropped up in a conversation because someone said, oh, this is brand new. No, it's not. I think a friend of mine, Steve Cullen, did it on a video on a YouTube thing. And if anyone is really intrigued, just get in touch with me, and I'll make sure I download that Steve's video so they get a good idea. I mean, he is Scots, so if anyone doesn't understand it, if not, I'll do it myself.
All right, perfect. And then, like we said, your website is the best place so they can get your email there.
Probably the best and the quickest way is just send me a message on Facebook, and that way I'll know I'm going to get it.
So I wanted to just kind of wrap up your take us to the stream. So you're there. So you've described the setup, the rod, the leader, and kind of the fly. So, and the technique. So that's pretty much it. And so you get started that way and then adjust as you need. I mean, why not that what you described there? Why wouldn't you just use that all of the time, even if the stream isn't super clear? Is there a reason why you wouldn't?
Oh, no, I'd use it all the time. I mean, it's a lovely way. You know, I love fishing. We call it duo fishing, or if there's three flies involved, trio fishing. It's just a lovely search method, which is, it always artistically it really does have a chord. It strikes a chord with me. It really does, Dave. I mean, I like fishing it. I mean, the lovely thing about fishing that hopper dropper didar method is that it allows you to cover water, and that, you know, it's super for water coverage, and it's visible, and it's just great for anyone who is newish to the sport. You've got them in the stream, and you've got them fishing at a depth which they can't see, that you know is productive, but giving them the visual opportunity of a dry fly and the movement. If it goes under or if a fish takes, you know, you've got that advantage. So, and that's good for a newcomer. It's good for, you know, not so newcomers, actually. So it works on so many levels. You know, as you go up, you know, as the streams around here get finer and you know, the water gets shallower, then you have to start looking at some fairly subtle versions and cast upstream to visible fish. And, you know, that's another side to nymph fishing, which is absolutely absorbing. I mean, watch a quarry to actually mark it, you know, look at its lie, work out how it's feeding in relationship to the current and the water column and the velocity, and then getting that fly to come down at that same depth or just to the side of it is for me the absolute quintessence of fly fishing.
Yep.
And I think, you know, it really is. I mean, I think that's why dry fly fishers don't like nymph fishing, because it's so difficult.
You know? Yeah, right. Well, I was just going to say, that was my question, is that, you know, casting a dry fly and making it plop and hit the surface and a fish come up can be challenging too. But you're saying this sounds like this is actually harder than dry fly.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I think nymph fishing done in that way is probably the hardest. It's the pinnacle of our sport. And having said that, I've fished way too many times on, you know, Dupuy and other, you know, like Henry's Fork, when there's a big hatch on, you know, when you're fishing dry flies, to realize that, you know, nymph fishing can be difficult. So can dry fly fishing too.
Yeah. Are you using any weight on the leader, or is this just weighted flies?
No, just weighted flies.
And
I would say this to anyone, as soon as you start weighting leaders, I abhor lead shot with a, you know, you know, I know everyone is a great fan over there, but oh no.
Yep.
No lead. You know, you can do anything with the types of flies that we're now designing in the way that we're designing them. You can overcome any current known to mankind. I mean, you can put in two or three tungsten beads if you want. You've got shell backs made out of tungsten. You've got all kinds of things that you can make part of the dressing that can add something to the dimension. And I don't see any reason to use lead shot apart from if you were using maybe streamers, maybe. But even then, we've got some fairly subtle, you know, lead impregnated leaders, poly leaders with tungsten in them. And and fly lines that sink too, sink tips. So there is really no need to use that. I can't see any advantage because it holds up differently in the water column. It doesn't make things look realistic. It deadens them, to my way of thinking. So there's an awful lot of reasons not to use it, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Well, let's we got a little segment on here we call the 222, which is the top two tips, top two flies, top two resources, and maybe we could just kind of maybe we could just think it on the nymphing. We've been talking about nymphing here, so you know, let's start with the flies. Are there a couple of flies, and take us again? We're going to your stream there. What would be two flies if you could put on? Yeah, okay. Well, I guess maybe let's just go in general. Let's just say if you had to pick two flies, you know, that's a hard one probably, but two flies for nymphing, what flies are your go-to?
Yeah, trouble is, to me, it's where they fish, not what they are. But, I mean, you know, it's the usual old thing. I'd want a pheasant tail. I mean, I would want a pheasant tail of some description, be it in a sort of a midge-like configuration or... just a classic style.
What about a pheasant tail with a flash, like a flashback pheasant tail, like a wing case of...
Yeah,
you like then, any of that stuff?
Yeah, okay, well, look, I'll concede. You can have your flashback pheasant tail as long as I can have my my copper-headed hare's ear, which I'll take all over.
That's true.
So I'd want one with a bit of flash and one definitely without, because I think there are days, Dave, when... You know, we've gone completely overboard with building in flash in flies.
What about these Euro nymphs? So you see these things out here, and they got, I mean, some of them don't even look like bugs, right? They're pink, they're purple.
Well, the pink fly came about because a grain love pink, especially after Christmas over here, because they're on salmon eggs and all the rest of it.
So, right.
You know, there is a reason to use them.
Mm-hmm. What about purple?
Do you know what? We don't have that many purple flies over here. We really don't. Not compared with you guys.
We got a purple. Really it's don't. Crazy. People love purple.
I know. And I think there is a genetic difference between our fish. I really do. I think, you know, that there are times or there are discrepancies between our various ways in which our fish will behave to certain things. And I just, you know, there's probably about two patterns that call for purple in the UK. That's about it. Now I'm running out of ideas. You know, I really am.
Right.
I mean, we do have the odd purple pattern for grayling, where we inject a bit of purple. But no.
Yeah.
I mean, really, they're very, very rare.
Very rare. So you got the pheasant tail. So in your other pattern, if it would be...
I definitely want a hare's ear. A hare's ear because there's always scud. There's always caddis. I mean, it's like the, you know, as Lefty said, it's a grocery store. You know, it's just there. So I've got two flies there that I know, one slightly light, one slightly dark. So, but where I would concede I'd want a bit of flash is probably in the thorax of the pheasant tail. And I'd use that peacock eye stub, which gives me all the flash I ever need, frankly.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and some of those dubs they do mix in a little bit. Well, even peacock can kind of look purplish depending on how the light
hits. But what the other thing I would actually ask for, if I was given the choice, is those flies but in different hook shape configurations.
Oh, right. Like what would be the hook? Different types of hooks.
I would want both styles. I would want the scud style, the grub curve style, and I'd also want the straight style. And I would literally alter the way in which I fish by the shape of the hook.
So if you had a scud style pheasant tail, how would you fish that?
Well, I mean, I'd fish it probably near the bottom, like a midge or something like that. So you've got those lovely options. So you've got a swimming nymph, in a straight shank, or you've got a curved one, which looks like a fetal position midge or something like that. So by having different hook weights and hook configurations, you can cover a multitude of sins, actually. You really can, if you think about it. The permutations that you can have as a nymph fisher, just by altering those two things, hook style and hook size, is bewildering, absolutely bewildering. And I think we all carry way too many patterns. You know?
That's totally true. I'll take a pheasant tail and a hare's, but I struggle with the hare's ear a little bit just on my tying because it's like proportions are always a little struggle. What's your, you know?
Proportions go to hell as soon as the trout starts eating them.
I mean, that's true. That's true.
Buggy anyway. Don't worry about it. Just go fish it.
Doesn't matter.
Don't obsess. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So basically, we're out there on the water. So we've got, say, we got the scud style, and then say the hare's ear is more of the straight style. How would you put one on the lead fly versus the, or how would you fish that if you wanted to get, one on the bottom and then one maybe
nice
emerging?
Simple. If I was fishing the scud one, I'd make that slightly bigger and have the, or vice versa, but I would make that the dominant one and then taper off and have a smaller pheasant tail or a pheasant tail up the leader.
On the dropper.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Definitely. Yeah, so you'd get it down on the bottom. Yeah, that makes sense. So you get the scud on the bottom.
I would use the hare's ear because it almost incites a bigger insect or creature.
And you'd put that on your lead fly?
Well, or not. I mean, I would use that as my fly to actually take me where I needed to go in depth terms, and either have coming off that on the point a small little pheasant tail. So it's hinging and articulating in the lower current, or I'd have it up the leader if I felt the fish were higher up in the water column.
How do fish adjust in the water column, do you think? You know, like, why would they be on the bottom versus
higher? Well, they've got fins, which, you know, help, you know, is the hydrofoil of them. But, I mean, I think it's determined very much by where the food is. And if there is not a hatch, and I've watched this so many times in the States, if there's a hatch in process, they will come up the various levels to accommodate the hatch. And they're very, very good at doing that. So if you're not seeing any activity on the surface, I would fish on the bottom. It's as simple as that. I mean, all right, they could be fishing mid-water, but there's always going to be a residue of fish at the bottom. That's where I'd look to fish. But I'd still want, you know, you've got your fly down there, but they may not take the big one, but they will be less suspicious of a little tiny one, say a little tiny pheasant tail, than they would a great big hairy hare's ear.
Yeah, so, right, hairs are, gotcha.
No, I use that very much as a stalking horse. You know, that's my Trojan horse that goes in and you know, gets me in through the door, and then I'm fishing, you know, a nice little delicate nymph thereafter. So, you know, one helps the other, which helps the other. But the nice thing about that system is if the fish do come up the water column, and by having a different style of hook or a different size of hook, I can immediately fish that pheasant tail up near the surface as an emerger if I need to.
Hmm. That's right. So it can be an emerger, just no bead head at all.
Just
do you put beads and you use beads on your fly sometimes?
Oh gosh, yeah. I've got loads of things. You know, I've got boxes. I mean, I've even, you know, done as George has done, which is, you know, still heavy. And I even got to the point of weighing the perishing things. I mean, that's a bit depressing.
Right.
Because, you know, certain manufacturers have beads that weigh substantially less than others, even though they're the same size. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to know. I don't like surprises. You know, if I go out in the water, I don't like surprises.
What do you use for a scale on those guys?
Oh, just a little jeweler's digital scales. I mean, you can get them off the internet for next to nothing. And you just put your bead on there and you go, oh, right, okay, well, just weigh your fly and boom, away you go. And that goes into the, you know, the whatever weight category. And so you build up a really good fly box of flies that you know what's going to happen as soon as you take them out of that box. I mean, I live a life of utter chaos. And I'm the most, you know, completely disorganized person of anyone I know. Until it comes to my fly box,
then you're good. Can we maybe get a picture of that fly box and put it in the show notes just so people could see what it looks like?
No,
I'd love to see what that looks like.
I'll do that.
So I love that. So chaos, and I guess, am I kind of the same way? I don't know. I guess I'm a little, I'm actually more chaos both ways. But so what does chaos mean in your normal life?
Well, just generally. I mean, I work in a state of, you know, complete illogical chaos. I mean, if anyone saw my working pattern during a day, they'd go, what on earth is happening? You know, what is going on? You know, how can this chat be productive? Well, clearly he isn't.
Right.
So consequently, you know, I have to have order somewhere, and it might as well be my fly box.
Exactly. That's right. Good. Well, we'll stick, we'll try to get a photo of that. Let's keep on the 222. So two tips. If you're out there nymph fishing, we got the setup we talked about. What, you know, if somebody's new to it, what kind of tips would you give them to help them find a fish?
I would, you know what, I'm going to do something really cheeky. I'm going to say, go fish with somebody that knows the water. That would be my top tip. You know, don't try and do this on your own. This madness. Even if I'm going into a new part of a state or whatever in America, I don't just assume I know it. You know, I find someone that knows that water. And you know, I will make hay whilst the sun shines because I'm with somebody that knows that water intimately, day in, day out. Now, if that's going to cost me a day's guiding fee, so be it. But it's going to pay me in dividends after. Even taking me to locations makes a big difference.
Yep.
And then pointing out the water, because each river, each section, Dave, is idiosyncratic. It really is. And you know, someone say, oh no, there's a undercut bank here, or there's a little, you know, sort of a back eddy over there, or you know, something. And so consequently, you know, you are getting and stealing a march on everybody else, including yourself, because if you think you can take on a new river or a new place on your own, then it's going to be the steepest learning curve, and you'll just get frustrated and won't fish well.
Yeah. What if you were a hardcore wet fly fisherman or dry fly fisherman? You knew the river pretty well, but you were trying nymphing for the first time. Would that be different? Would you maybe give somebody a different tip there?
Probably. If they were dry fly fishing, I'd say, look, just use a nymph, but fish it in the same way as you'd fish a dry fly. But have some kind of indication that you're used to. So have an indicator, have a small indicator, have a, you know, use a hopper drop, use something that you are familiar with. Don't go too far out of your comfort zone that you don't enjoy the experience. Because if you're coming to a new way of operating, you've got to have confidence in that thing working. You won't have confidence in it because you won't have seen it work. You know it works, but it hasn't worked for you. So you have to buy in that confidence somehow, some way. So consequently, by using something you're familiar with is almost an encouragement to fish something different beyond that. So hopper dropper is an ideal solution.
The hopper dropper is great.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And how would, on that hopper dropper, how would you set that up if you had two flies? How would you?
Right. If it was a newcomer, I'd have 12 foot of leader down to about, say, 5-6x, probably 5x. And then I get 6x or 5x, depending on the type of fish I was fishing for. You know, if it's a big fish or whatever in big sprawling river, then you don't want to fish too light. But 5x, 6x is fine. I wouldn't want to go too much heavier, because the heavier the nylon, the bigger the diameter. And if you're fishing nymphs, that diameter is going to be the thing that holds up in the water column. And this is something that people overlook, that by using heavy diameter nylon, you are actually restricting the depth in which you're fishing.
Right.
So
That's it.
I would go with 5 or 6x, probably 5. And I would create my dropper, you know, about 4 inches or so thereabouts. And then below that, about 18 inches, maybe a bit longer, depends on where I'm fishing, I would put that nymph. And I would,
the nymph.
And I would go with, you know, something like, you know, even a prince nymph, something that is, you know, something that's got a confidence factor built in. But I would go for a 12 or a 14 or something like that. I wouldn't go too much smaller because, again, you're inviting problems purely psychologically because of the size. Oh, gosh, that's a bit small. That won't ever work. They won't see that.
Right.
So you're trying to build in as many things that a person might find accommodating as is humanly possible.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Oh, that's awesome. Those are great. Okay. So now let's take it to, so we kind of have a couple of that, kind of tips and flies and stuff. What about resources? If somebody wanted to dig into nymphing, I guess maybe we talked about George's book, Dynamic Nymphing.
You don't need any other, actually.
Oh, right. Just George's. So get Dynamic Nymphing.
Just get Dynamic Nymphing. It's all in there. Sure there are others. I'm sure there are, there's one that has just come out over here called The Nymphfisher's Bible. I'm always worried about the word Bible.
Yeah, the Bible.
In a book. So, it's just all there. It's just, there's just so much information there that you don't really need another book. And the nice thing is it's current and it's, it's accessible and and George is a nice chap.
George is great. I'll put a link out to the episode we have with George. The great thing about George is he mentioned Joe Humphreys, who we also had on here. And he talked about, I loved it always because George talked about how Joe would slap him around back in the day to get him to fish better, right? He'd be like, almost because he was a wrestler. Yeah. He said if George wasn't doing a good job, Joe would just like hit him in the head and stuff.
Really?
And like, come on. He'd get him fired up. And I was like, man, that's some serious stuff. So that shows you George's background, why he is the way he is, probably a little bit.
But also, it's probably made him very calm and very nice beyond that. But it just goes to show the age too. You try and do that now, cool, righty,
right?
That wouldn't work.
No, I love it. This has been awesome, Charles. I think we're about there. Just a couple more things. I don't want to miss. There's a couple of big ones. Your art, we're probably not going to go deep into that, but maybe for a little bit, touch on your art. How is that something you do just as much as your fly fishing, or how does all that look?
Quite a lot at the moment. I've just been commissioned for a whole range of magazines. So it's taking up an awful lot more time than I really intended. But no, I try and create a balance because life is about balance, and I celebrate the fact that not only I can do it, but I can do other things too. So I can walk away from it, which is good, which is healthy, I think. Because when it's not going well, and it very often doesn't actually, you want distance and you want the pressure vacuum, I think, of being able to walk away and do something entirely different. So going onto a riverbank for me is just the best. I can just go, okay, and come back to something refreshed and re-energized. So it is an important string to what I do, and it's something, it's always been work. My father's installed that into me that, if you pick up a brush, it's no different than somebody picking up a trowel if you're bricklaying whatever. It's a tool.
And, it's all art. And a tool, right?
Yeah, you're not on some higher calling and some different being. You're just a technician that works with different medium than other people. And that I've never lost,
I love that.
Well, it's true. I'm lucky I can put things roughly where I want them to go in a color that I like to think that is an interpretation of what I see and what others might see. But does that make me any different to anyone else? No, of course it doesn't.
I love talking to, you know, artists, and I recently had somebody in our audience. We have this kind of a group for members that people go in deeper with the podcast, and he had this conversation. I have conversations with, you know, whenever I can, listeners of the show, and we were talking, and I was asking him why he paid, and he said he thought of me as basically a local artist, you know, with the podcast, right? Like I'm just somebody creating this thing, and I never really thought of it that much, but I think we all have a little bit of artist in us, right?
Yeah.
Whatever we do, like you're saying.
Anything that you create and anything that is creative is art. I mean, it is the most broadest spectrum thing that you could possibly have. You know, it really is. And art can be anything you want it to be. Hence the word artful.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's right there. Exactly. It's right there in the English language.
That's it. All right, Charles. Well, hey, in the next, you know, 6 to 12 months, anything you want to give a shout out? New
guy
coming
or
anything?
Yeah, don't give me another platform. I'll be gobbling.
Yeah, give a shout.
Loving it. But thank you for this, Dave. It's been an amazing, you know, hour and a bit, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it has. It has. Yeah, I think we're a good hour and a half in. This is that. I always feel that the shows that are great are the ones where you turn around and your guest is kind of like, wow, I didn't realize it was already an hour. You know
absolutely.
What I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah. It's been fun. I love it. I think that's the. I found my little, you know, this is my little thing that I just, you know, the one thing I found that I'm pretty good at, you know, as far as just talking to people, you know what I mean? Like that's
well,
one
that's
of those
an
things
art,
that
you see, that is an art. There you go. You know, you want to know what art is. That's it right there.
We just did it. We just hour and a half of art right there.
Yeah.
So if people want to connect with you, it's at charlesjardine.co.uk, right?
It's Charles at charlesjardine.co.uk.
Yeah, that's right, Charles. All right, perfect. All right, Charles. Well, hey, thanks for all the time today. Yeah, we'll keep in touch with you as we go. And
absolutely.
We'll catch up with everything and talk
That'd
to you
be amazing.
Soon.
Thanks, Dave. It's been a real treat. Thank you.
If you can't check out our next live podcast, just head over to wetflyswing.com/live. And you can actually send me a DM there if you can't get in, and I'll give you an invite. That's the best way to stay on top of that. I want to give you a quick heads up. Next Tuesday, a week from now, we've got a great episode with Bob Clay, who makes a sweet bamboo spade rod. We hear about Bob, what he has going over there, and what's coming up in the next few years if you want to get a bamboo spade rod. So that's all I have for you today. Just wanted to thank you again for stopping by to check out the show today and listening. If you have any questions, please reach out to me anytime, and hope to maybe catch you online or on the river.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.